If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Welcome back to the program with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick. Today, Thursday, the 2nd of May in Europe and the United States still, and already Friday, the 3rd of May, if you're tuning in from Australia. Well, if you're wondering what's been happening to Patrick Henningsen, you can find out by going to 21stcenturywire.com, where the transcript of his interview with Andriy Derkach has just been published. And I quote, "Recently, I had an opportunity to sit down with former Ukrainian parliamentarian Andriy Derkach to discuss his thoughts and insights regarding the historic developments which are taking place in his home country. His long career in Ukrainian politics and established body of work in investigating and tracking financial corruption has given him a unique inside perspective on a number of timely stories, including the role of the Biden family and US government agencies in fostering a culture of corruption in Ukraine. Because of his work in this area, he's been sanctioned and forced to flee his country. During a recent interview with Italian-American journalist Simona Mangianti, Derkach revealed the existence of an extra budgetary fund that was being used to fund international terrorist activities. Not long after that interview, a serious terror attack took place in Moscow's Crocus City Hall. We initially pick up on this point of the financing of terrorism, as well as new revelations regarding the 2022 attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. The discussion then moves to the beleaguered state of Ukraine, chronicling its political fragmentation and economic collapse following the Maidan coup and leading to the current NATO proxy war against Russia, followed by the government's attack on the Orthodox Church and the likely fate of the country's embattled president, Volodymyr Zelensky." So when you can't get any reception good enough to listen to TNT on the rolling news, or perhaps if you're listening to us on the radio and want to read something at the same time, head over to 21stcenturywire.com for Patrick's interview with Andriy Derkach. Meanwhile, tonight in Europe, Emmanuel Macron is having dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping and German Chancellor Scholz, who interpolated himself in that happy little gathering. It's interesting that Xi chose to go to France first, given that Macron has been one of those closest to calling for European troops on the ground in Ukraine, fighting directly against the Russians, who are, of course, China's ally. Meanwhile, while awaiting American aid, Ukraine's gunners are apparently firing very sparingly at the advancing Russians, with Russia saying it sees no point in the peace talks in Switzerland. Joining me now to discuss this and other aspects of the European theatre of geopolitics is Swedish geopolitical analyst and author Mats Nilsson, joining me from Stockholm. Welcome to the programme, Mats.
Thank you very much, Patrick. On the Patrick Henningsen show. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Xi in Europe, he's going to France and then he's going to Hungary and Serbia. Hungary, of course, the country that was holding back European Union support for Zelensky's regime. They held out the longest, though they finally caved in, of course. And Serbia, traditionally allied with Russia, still not a member of the European Union. The Chinese have invested a lot of money in a project to link the capitals of the two countries, Budapest and Belgrade, with a high-speed rail network similar to the ones that they have in their own country. And that project is due to come to fruition in the next few years. There was a time when somebody like Xi would have felt it a requirement to go to London or perhaps meet with Angela Merkel during a trip to Europe. But now he's being more selective, and it's his favourites, one could say, Orban and the new government of Serbia, where he's chosen to position himself. Nevertheless, the fact that there's this intimate dinner taking place with Scholz, the wives of the two leader of the two presidents, Macron and Xi, and the two men themselves, of course, should at least give us some cause for hope, because out of dialogue might come peace, Mats. Or am I naively optimistic?
One of these difficult questions, because it always boils down to who's to gain. And I'm carefully optimistic that these talks that are only, apparently the talks are only attended by Xi and Scholz and Macron and their respective wives. There will be no other attendees, no advisors or as such, according to the reports. There might be some frank discussions, because it's obvious to anyone with a functioning brain, and for all their faults, both Scholz and Macron are not stupid individuals. They know that the European Union, and especially both France and Germany, are in great need of Chinese strength, or of Chinese industry and Chinese trade. So hopefully there will be some temperance to the rhetoric that is proclaimed from especially Washington and London in relation to what's to be done about China. So perhaps cooler continental heads can prevail during these discussions. And France has a historic allegiance with China. They were one 60 years ago, they were one of the first Western countries to adapt and establish diplomatic relations with the new communist regime of the People's Republic of China. I'm cautiously optimistic, because as always, money talks. And I'm thinking that the financial elites of both France and Germany are whispering in the ears of Macron and Scholz, be careful what you tell and do with and to China. The manufacturers of both France and of Germany need China. They need the investments, they need the trade. And that boils down to the fact that no president or prime minister can survive an election if the economy goes from bad to worse. And frankly speaking, the economy in both France and Germany is down in around the worse area already. So the last thing that Macron and Scholz needs is a turn for the even more worse. So my assessment, fingers crossed, cool heads will prevail, and diplomacy might actually be given a chance to function as it should. Giorgio is always better than war, as I've said before.
Absolutely. Macron is apparently going to take Xi Jinping to the Pyrenees, where the French president spent time with his grandmother as a child. That's a particularly sort of intimate invitation that you wouldn't advance to anybody you decried as an enemy. So while the hotheads on Capitol Hill in Washington seem determined to ramp up the rhetoric, of course, and have provided billions of dollars in military assistance and aid to Taiwan to back that up as part of that ludicrous $80-90 billion package for Israel and Ukraine as well. Nevertheless, Macron here does appear to be breaking ranks with NATO, one could say, in attempting to forge genuinely friendly relations. Apparently, Macron often went to this Pyrenean region with his beloved maternal grandmother, Germaine Noguet, who died in 2013 and lived in Bagnères de Bigorre. The Pyrenean trip is designed to create an almost intimate moment that should seal the relationship between the two men, according to La Dépêche, a French newspaper. A lot of people talk about war with China as being an inevitability, and I'm no fan of Macron, but he has to be applauded here in at least I mean, you know, enacting his own type of diplomacy. Let's put it that way. He was seen elsewhere in a bromance recently, wasn't he? Was that in Brazil with Lula? You know, he does seem to plow his own furrow in much the same way that Jacques Chirac did a generation ago.
He's difficult to read. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Macron who said that NATO was a brain dead organization, if you remember. But now he's also the Macron who says that you need a defense bond, a European Union defense bond, and France will be more than willing to send French troops to Ukraine. So you never really know where you have Macron, but since he's doing this, what you could call personal diplomacy. I mean, it's like when great leaders invite other leaders to meet the family or to go to a place, secluded place, somewhere outside of the capital. It's always a sign that there is a vested interest or there is a genuine interest in deepening the connections and basically setting the table for a long-term communication. I'm like I said, I'm carefully optimistic about the French and the Chinese being able to establish some kind of baseline for further discussions. However, you never know. I mean, it's just von der Leyen might come in tomorrow or next week and ruin everything with another demand on European Union sanctions against China, or Borrell might say that the European Union might need to send its military to protect Taiwan. Have it what you may. There are always ways to quickly evaporate whatever advancements were made within the diplomatic sphere. It's difficult to establish a relationship, but it's very quickly destroyed. I think we've seen that proven time and time again over the last 5 to 10 years when diplomacy has just left the building, gone down to the pub for a beer, and let the military wars take over, sadly enough.
Things are always very choreographed and symbolic, and the Chinese certainly don't mess about. They apparently sent an 80-strong delegation to the Pyrenees region on a reconnaissance mission in advance of Xi's visit, and visited La Mongie, a ski resort Mr. Macron is known to like. The president apparently wants to take his Chinese counterpart to the Pic du Midi, a Pyrenean mountain that's the site of an observatory that has partnerships with various countries. Now, of course, the bugbear as far as the European Union is concerned are the subsidies that China pays to its electric car manufacturers, which are undercutting, enabling them to basically sell their cars much cheaper than European manufacturers can. That's the big bone of contention on the economic front. And according to the release, the exchanges between the two men will focus on those issues, as well as international crises. That can only mean the Middle East and Ukraine, which is first and foremost, scientific, trade issues, cultural and sporting cooperation, according to the Elysee office. Macron will also discuss joint actions to tackle global challenges, in particular the climate emergency, the protection of biodiversity, and the financial situation of the most vulnerable countries. Beijing, for its part, of course, insists it's neutral in the Ukraine conflict, but has been criticized for refusing to condemn Moscow for its offensive. And the United States is directly accusing China of helping Russia carry out its biggest militarization since Soviet times. After visiting France, Xi is going to Hungary, which has attracted a flood of major Chinese projects in recent years, most related to battery and electric vehicle manufacturing, as well, of course, as the high-speed rail. Surely Europe wouldn't be so stupid as to flush all this down the proverbial pan on the say-so of hawkish Americans.
Never underestimate the stupidity of European nations trying to work together. Just a few hours ago, I actually saw a report of the French state television France 2, who were airing a show about an alleged clandestine operation of Chinese police in Paris. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but it's available on France 2 broadcast, and they have a short trailer of what's to be sent. And this proves that there are always forces working to try and destabilize any means or any talk about creating a de-escalation, because there's no profit in peace. So one wonders what this French TV special was all about. Apparently the Chinese embassy has made a very powerful rebuttal, saying that this was a man who came to the Chinese embassy who was very clearly deranged and had some mental issues, and he was apparently a member of the Falun Gong. So there are always forces working to destroy any diplomatic effort made, and it's quite easy, because through stealth you can always project strength. And for all its faults, both the MI6 and the CIA are quite good at working stealthily. So I think that if Macron is sincere about trying to keep China as a trade partner, or as a partner with France and the European Union, he's going to have to fight for it, because there will be forces who will be trying to create failure. If I can express myself that way. So, I mean, as for Hungary and Serbia, it's Hungary was the first European Union country to sign up to the Belt and Road Initiative. And of course, I think Xi wants to reward Hungary for its loyalty and for its perseverance in sticking with the Belt and Road Initiative. And I think it's the same with Serbia. And both these countries will probably be reaping some economic rewards from China, perhaps new car factories or other investments. Who knows? But the tables have definitely turned, and now it's China that's contacting European countries and saying, what kind of support do you want from us, not the other way around. I'm not underestimating, like I said, I'm not underestimating the stupidity of the European Union when they try to work together. So it might well be that the European Union flushes it down the toilet.
Indeed. And there's the case as well, of course, of Maximilian Krah, the member of the European Parliament with the Alternative for Deutschland party, who is under preliminary investigation by German police after his staffer, Jian Guo, was arrested on Monday, and after a separate incident in which he is accused of taking money from Kremlin agents. Mr. Guo, of course, accused of being a Chinese spy. And one wonders whether this is an attempt simply to discredit the AFD, to cause trouble with China, or perhaps there's something more genuine behind it. Mr. Guo was arrested in Dresden on suspicion of passing sensitive information about the European Parliament to China's Ministry of State Security. He is also suspected of spying on Chinese opposition figures. Mr. Krah has denied any personal wrongdoing and said in the wake of the arrest that he will fire the aide. Forgive my cynicism, but what could there possibly be that's sensitive about the workings of the European Parliament that China's Ministry of State would want to know? the European Parliament is a completely useless, powerless talking shop. Am I being too dismissive, Mats?
No, of course not. I work there myself, and I can attest to what you say. The only thing I can think of is it's the parliamentary system. It's notoriously hard to find any information you need. Even me, as an educated lawyer, having even worked there, still find it hard to find anything within all the different committees and subcommittees and voting lists and all the rest of it. So I'm probably guessing that some Chinese perhaps asked this man for assistance of trying to what the hell is everyone doing? And as for the timing, I'm thinking that the German Secret Service, I forgot their acronym right now, but the German Secret Service, I think this is information that they've had for some time. As all secret intelligence agencies do, they have a lot of semi-huge scandals that they're sitting on. And when the time is right, they release them. It was the same in Sweden a few weeks ago when Iran was on the table, and suddenly the Swedish secret police revealed that there was an Iranian couple who was charged on conspiracy to kill murder Jewish people in Sweden. But this wasn't now. It had been a few months or almost a year ago. But if it's convenient for other reasons to release this kind of information, which isn't, I mean, this fellow who was this German fellow who's under investigation now, I think if we try to Google him in 6 months' time, it's just going to say that the courts of whatever city in Germany handled this dismissed the case because nothing could be proven. But the damage is done to the AfD in the upcoming European parliamentary election. The damage is done, and they've held it until it's, for obvious reasons, it's good for them, the vested interests within the security and secret services, to release the information. And then it's a big hoo-ha. And everyone who reads the papers or just watches the evening news, they say, "Oh, the AfD, they're connected to China. That's China communists. That's bad." And then the AfD might lose a few percentage in the vote. Like I said, if we check him out in 6 to 8 months' time, I'm certain he won't be in jail. He will probably just be out of a job and trying to get back on his feet. So it's once again the smoke and mirrors and the cloak and daggers at work.
Well, the AfD, of course, the only party in Germany seeking an accommodation with Russia and an end to the war there. In spite of that, being the only viable peace party in the Bundestag, they are dismissed as far right. I mean, I always thought peace parties were associated with the left. The German government have been quite open about the fact that they'd like to ban the AfD in the name of democracy. Make sense of that, if you will, banning political parties in order to save democracy. And they've also suffered from allegations that Peter Bistrin, also an AfD politician and candidate running in the European elections, received €20,000 in cash from the manager of a Russian propaganda network while sitting in a parked car. Mr. Bistrom has denied any wrongdoings, but as you say, Mats, that has dropped the AfD to third in the polls. Alice Weidel, co-leader of that party, dismissed the claims as politically motivated. "I just see that our party is being discredited," she said. We're going to take a short break now with the network. When we come back, it's a question of numbers. $60 billion to arm Ukraine, $30 billion to rebuild Gaza. But we know where America's priorities lie. We'll be right back after this short break.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
I started to investigate John F. Kennedy. That's 60 years ago. My lawyer is a specialist in that, and we did a podcast together in Germany, which is quite popular. And I have to say, I was shocked when I went deep into the Kennedy case that there still are people who say that he was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, and that's it. It's incredible. So, Pelle, what is your take? You're writing the book. What is your focus on it?
I mean, I think that the truth is discoverable. I mean, it's in with these assassinations, you don't need to go down a rabbit hole. I mean, it's five or six people in a physical place and time, and often using quite simple weaponry, guns and so on.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
Today's news talk, TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen. Awaiting American aid, Ukraine's gunners are firing sparingly at advancing Russians. Soldiers manning a US-supplied M777 howitzer close to the front in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region have seen the enemy advance in recent weeks, slowly but surely, and they wish they could do more to stop it. If we compare it with the beginning of the full-scale invasion, when we fired up to 100 shells a day, then now, when we fire 30 shells, it's a luxury, according to artillery gun commander Oleksandr Kozachenko, speaking to Reuters. Sometimes the number of shells fired daily is in single digits, he added. During a recent visit to the outpost, part of Ukraine's 148th separate artillery brigade, Kozachenko's team were able to fire fairly regularly. However, units like this are still waiting for a fresh influx of ammunition after a new $61 billion US aid package was approved last week. Meanwhile, we hear from the Deputy General Secretary of the United Nations, speaking at a press conference in Jordan, Abdullah al-Dardari, that the cost of rebuilding Gaza will be between $30 and $40 billion, so still less than the amount spent resupplying Ukraine, considerably less. According to AFP, he added that Gaza's reconstruction were to be carried out by a normal process, it would take decades, and the Palestinian people simply do not have the luxury of waiting for decades. 72% of all residential buildings have been completely or partially destroyed, as well, of course, as 35,000 people killed and tens of thousands more wounded. Interesting, isn't it, Mats, that US Congress can immediately find $61 billion of entirely what one might call funny money. They don't have the money. They're actually mortgaging the futures, not just of current generation of American taxpayers, but the next two or three generations of American taxpayers, just so that that artillery unit on the Eastern Front can fire more shells every day. Meanwhile, Gaza lies in ruins. And will the Americans come up with the money to rebuild it? I should think they'll suddenly find that Capitol Hill has run out of cash when it comes to actually doing something genuinely humanitarian and constructive. It is a pretty dreadful situation, isn't it, Maz?
It's dreadful, but it's highly predictable. The money that's, or the aid money that's, it's so nicely put, aid to Ukraine, is, as we know, mostly aid to the pork barrel politics of the United States. It goes to certain select manufacturers of certain select weaponry systems within the United States. It's American mortgage taxpayers' money, and they pay these military industries, who then ship off the weapons to Ukraine. And the profits made are then returned to the pockets of the people in Congress. And then you start over again. You find another war where you can do this. The problem with giving billions to rebuild Gaza is that these billions are, would probably go to actually, you know, building houses and other entrepreneurs that aren't stationed within the United Nations and that aren't part of the military industrial complex, because building houses and repairing waterworks and getting the electricity going again and rebuilding bombed out hospitals is not something that pays the congressmen's I wouldn't say wages, that's not something that pays the congressmen's bribes just as much. So obviously they're not going to find any money for this kind of aid. They're just going to keep pumping steel into Ukraine, which for obvious reasons isn't going to help Ukraine, because the war is won by, all wars boil down to statistics and logistics. And statistically, Ukraine doesn't have enough manpower to man the guns and pass the ammunition. So in essence, they're sending material to Ukraine that's probably going to be left there, just like they left material in Afghanistan once the Ukrainian front line collapses due to a lack of military men that can be behind the guns. It's just, like I said before, it's just a tragic farce. And no matter what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, Ukraine has already lost. It's just a matter of how many more months it's going to take until Zelensky realizes that he has to negotiate a ceasefire, and how many more will have died before we reach this this time and place.
An article in Foreign Affairs magazine last week, the in-house journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, advocating European troops on the ground, if not directly in conflict with Russia, then supporting them. And that's something that Macron has repeatedly said for all his impending love-in with Xi. He nevertheless has said, reiterated in an interview with The Economist last week, that he doesn't rule out sending French troops to Ukraine if Russia breaks through the front lines and Kiev requests soldiers. That's surely only a matter of time, isn't it? The Russians could break through the front line whenever they want. You know, the stalemate is only stale because the Russians are holding back to some extent.
Yes, and quite rightly holding back, because as long as Ukrainian forces still try and go on the offensive, which is suicidal, but it happens, and on certain aspects of the front line, Ukrainian troops are still advancing. If I were a Russian general, I would do it like they're doing it right now, moving slowly forward. A lot of Western commentators mistake this war for a 100-meter dash. Russia obviously knows it's not a 100-meter dash. It's a marathon. And Russia has thoroughly prepared themselves. I think Putin has mentally somewhere been preparing Russia for this since 2007. And once again, logistics and statistics, the logistical power of Russia being able to put up manpower and material, it's really not up for discussion. Russia will be able to push Ukraine back as far as it pleases. That said, there is no indication that it would be suicidal for Putin to start pushing further into the, shall I say, the more Ukrainian parts of Ukraine. Because you can never occupy any part of a country that doesn't want to be occupied. Israel and Palestine, case in point. But if Russia wants to occupy the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine, they could do so tomorrow. But they're doing it slowly as to minimize the casualties, both the Russian casualties and the casualties on the Ukrainian side. But I think things will obviously heat up, especially now that not only France, but also Finland, Poland, and the three Baltic Chihuahuas have said that they will be sending they might be sending their military troops as advisors to Ukraine. And I use the words advisors in the same sense of the word American advisors to Vietnam, meaning that they will soon be taking part in offensive action against the Russians. But the question will be, in what capacity will they be there? And what will happen with the propaganda once a French or many French soldiers are killed by the Russians? It's always touch and go. We're living on the edge of a greater war between NATO and Russia. But hopefully, cooler heads will prevail, and there will be a ceasefire arrangement before Russia and NATO comes head to head. But as long as there are European politicians going on about the mantra, Russia can't win, we're living just a few weeks away from a full-blown world war, basically, because this mantra is just pure, it's just pure silliness. Russia has already won, so it doesn't matter how many times the Estonian Kala says Russia can't win. Russia has already won. It doesn't do well for her to tell the truth, so she keeps repeating this, which is dangerous, because soon it will become a truth. And when it does, NATO and Russia might risk going head-to-head in a all-out war that may or may not be with the nuclear weapons involved.
Fortunately, Britain's unelected Foreign Secretary, the old Etonian David Cameron, does not possess one of those karma heads. He's been on a flying visit to Kyiv only today, where he promised £3 billion, nearly $4 billion, of military aid for Ukraine, adding that he will continue to do so for as long as it takes. We will give £3 billion every year for as long as is necessary. We've just really emptied all we can in terms of giving equipment, he said, speaking to Reuters today. Some of that equipment is actually arriving in Ukraine today while I'm here. He added, and this is the particularly dangerous rhetoric, that Ukraine had a right to use the weapons provided by London to strike targets inside Russia, and that it was up to Kyiv whether it chose to do so. Ukraine has that right. I've heard those words before. They were used by Keir Starmer when talking about Israel's siege of Gaza. Whenever you hear somebody saying a country has that right, you need to, listen very carefully to what comes next, because it's likely to be highly irresponsible and possibly genocidal. He went on, just as Russia is striking inside Ukraine, you can quite understand why Ukraine feels the need to make sure it's defending itself. He was speaking outside St. Michael's Cathedral. It's absolutely crucial, not just in terms of the weapons it will bring, but also the boost to morale that it will bring to the people here in Ukraine. And further to that, Avril Haines, officially the America's top spy as director of the National Intelligence Agency, she testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee today that Russia has stepped up its attacks on Ukraine's infrastructure to hamper Kyiv's ability to move weapons to the front. And she does not expect the war to end anytime soon. Mats, a final word. Sweden now in NATO, NATO troops arriving, your traditionally neutral or even pacifist bases suddenly overrun with American soldiers and similar personnel. That all happened ridiculously quickly, with Ukraine being positioned as the most important country in the world right now in terms of its defense. Where are the Swedish people standing with respect to their newfound membership of NATO? And how do they feel about now becoming one of the biggest aircraft carriers in the Baltic?
Well, I don't think most Swedes have any real grasp of the situation. It was quickly imposed of us during a time of created panic. As you know, historically, the fear of Russia has always been embedded into the Swedish psyche. Even though historically our archenemy are the Danes, which we have had the most wars with. But as of late, of course, it's been Russia. So it was quite easy to get us into NATO. But now we're I think more and more people are starting to questioning the rationale behind the membership. What will it actually give us? Because suddenly there is all this talk about we have to make investments in roads. We have to make huge investments within the medical infrastructure to be able to take care of NATO troops, and we have to actually invest more to give more money to our military. When we were having the discussion of NATO membership or not NATO membership, there was politicians saying if we enter NATO, we won't have to pay as much to the military because NATO will be partly backing us up, so we will actually pay less. This has obviously been forgotten by the politicians today, and we're lavishly spending huge amounts of money on the military. And the main discussion in Sweden now is the so-called DCA agreement. Now, this is an agreement pertaining to putting American troops in Sweden, and it's not actually as such a part of the NATO membership. But almost all NATO countries have a DCA agreement. The interesting thing is that Sweden has agreed to some rather legally horrific changes which within our Swedish law. So we will be giving up 17 of our bases to an American presence. And there are a lot of things in this agreement. For example, once the agreement is set and accepted by Parliament and the legal changes are made, the only people who are exempt from persecution in Sweden will be the king and American soldiers. They will have their own right to protect the base areas. The base areas will be tax-free. Their own laws will be applicable to these areas, and also they will also have their own courts set up so it will be running a parallel legal system within the Swedish borders, and there are quite a few other details. They will be exempt from different kind of fees and things like this. But especially on the part of the fact that Swedish police will have no jurisdiction over these military bases, it's for me, as I'm legally schooled, and it's alarming. It's a very huge step from anything that we've ever decided upon before, and there is no real discussion about this agreement. As always, when the mainstream media is told to shut up about something, they kindly oblige and shut up about it. I think, sadly, most Swedes will be informed about the effects of this agreement when a tragedy strikes. For example, if an American troop carrier strikes a Swedish bus and the Swedes are killed, and then the driver won't be able to be persecuted in Sweden, but he will be shipped off to America and be slapped on the fingers. I think you had this case in England a few years ago when this young boy was run down on his bicycle by the wife of a military member in the UK, and she was quickly shipped out of England and back to the United States, and thus held back from persecution.
That's right.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Because we drive on the other side of the road. She went, it was a very, very sad case indeed, and she simply skipped the country.
Yeah, and this is basically where we will be having a lot. I think we will be having quite a lot of, and Sweden will actually not be, they will be, we will be leaving the capacity to say no. American soldiers and military material will come and go as they please within the Swedish borders. So there are people trying to get a discussion about this, but it will be accepted in Parliament in about 1 month time. And then for all intents and purposes, Sweden will be an occupied country.
That's right. It's the end of Swedish sovereignty, de facto.
Yes.
Mads Nielsen, thank you so much for joining us with your gentle insight and searing wisdom, as always. Great that you could be with us tonight, Mads.
Thank you, Basil.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be joined by Brian Hesher-McLean for the latest on the campus unrest across America. We'll be right back after this short break.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Many pollution sources can affect the air you breathe, from power plants and vehicles to dust and wildfires. Knowing more about local air quality can help you protect your health. If you're thinking about buying an air sensor, EPA has a series of videos to help you get the most out of it. Learn how EPA collects and uses regulatory data, how EPA communicates health messaging, and how to interpret the readings from your sensor. Visit epa.gov/air-sensor-toolbox.
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the program with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen for the final 10 minutes. As you can probably tell, it's 10 to 11 here in the UK, but much earlier in the United States. UCLA apparently decided to call in police to disassemble the encampment that had been up on campus to preserve campus safety after it was unable to reach an agreement with the leaders of the protesters, according to Chancellor Jean D. Block. Yet an arrestee says police just kept shooting tear gas and rubber bullets. Ginger Shankar, a Los Angeles resident who is not a UCLA student but joined the campus protests, heard police helicopters begin circling above the encampment around 9 o'clock last night. 4 hours later, she said chaos erupted. That's it, obviously at 1 o'clock in the morning, as police shot tear gas and rubber bullets into the encampment indiscriminately. They were so crazy, she said. They just kept shooting. At around 5:30 a.m., she joined dozens of protesters who had locked arms to prevent police from entering the encampment. She said she heard an officer say, "Whose arm are we going to dislocate?" It doesn't make any sense, does it? Brian McLean, joining me now, host of State of the Nation. How can the Chancellor possibly say that he'd called the police in riot gear, firing rubber bullets and tear gas, to preserve campus safety? I mean, it's quite the opposite. 200 people arrested, according to Police Chief Dominic Choi. And now there are protesters as close as they can get to the downtown LA jail where their colleagues are being held. This is really turning into something, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. Police have arrested more than 2,000 people during pro-Palestinian protests at college campuses across the United States in the last couple weeks here. Those numbers are according to Associated Press releases. But yes, the big news is in the last 24 hours, they've drawn the most attention over there at University of California in Los Angeles. And there have been some very chaotic scenes going on there. Early this morning, we had officers in riot gear surging a crowd of demonstrators. And as you said, armed with non-lethal rounds from their shotguns, you know, rubber bullets is pretty much what we refer to those as. But they're extremely damaging. If they hit you in the extremities, it hurts very bad. And if it hits you in the head or an eye or in the jaw, you know, you can have permanent damage. People have even died by getting hit close to the, you know, in close range with those before. So they're saying in KTLA that hundreds of reporters, protesters at UCLA defied the orders to leave. So they were telling them, they're saying that they were telling them for 3 or 4 hours that they're about to be arrested before they started getting into it. And flashbangs were thrown in, tear gas was thrown in. At least 200 people were arrested there at the UCLA campus. So they've all been booked into the county jail complex near downtown Los Angeles. And it's up to UCLA police to determine what charges to bring. That's somewhat interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that is interesting because given that they were on college grounds, what can they possibly be accused of? Of course, if the bill currently making its way through Congress becomes law, that will codify the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism as singling out Israel for criticism, amongst other new absurd terms, then perhaps they could be charged with that, because obviously the whole point of the protest is to single out Israel for criticism, because it has massacred 35 plus thousand people and mutilated thousands more. I'm very pleased to see, though, that on the NBC Rolling News, I mean, this is just a tiny little teardrop, if you like, of truth coming through the wall of propaganda. Benjamin Kirsten, a UCLA student and member of the student group Jewish Voice for Peace. I wonder how many times that organization has been profiled or platformed on NBC. Very, very few, I would venture to suggest. He said, and I have no reason to disbelieve him, that the encampment was peaceful until counter-protesters stormed in and then police swarmed the areas. I've spent a lot of time in the encampment, he said this morning, with flashbangs set off by police audible in the background. It's clear to me that this encampment would have been a peaceful endeavor if not for the continual presence of counter-protesters and now a very large, significant presence of law enforcement. It's an intense scene here. Asked about outside groups hijacking the protests, he added, I've certainly seen community support for the encampment, but I would describe the encampment very much as student-led. I think what I found most concerning is the rotating presence of counter-protesters, including their late hours of the night. It certainly seems that the pro-Israel mob were very well organized, well funded. They had fireworks and weapons of their own, and rather like in a bizarre sort of mirror image of what happens in the West Bank and Gaza, they were provoked simply by the fact that people were standing up for Palestine. That is enough to send a Zionist into a violent frenzy. It's happened all over the Middle East, and now it's happening in America. It's really quite bizarre, the irony of the parallel, Brian.
Yeah, the parallels and inversions and hypocrisies are getting too thick to count. There's a forest of them that we're wading through right now. Also a forest of propaganda. Quickly here, I know you got to wrap soon. And by the way, on behalf of Patrick and All of us fans of the Patrick Henningsen Show, thank you for staying up late every night this week to cover for Patrick while he's been doing this amazing reporting. But let me get this out real quick. While the pro-Palestinian out of KTLA again, while the pro-Palestinian encampment at UCLA was dramatically broken up in law enforcement raid early Thursday morning, similar protests remained and in some cases grew and are growing at other universities throughout Southern California. So pro-Palestinian protests, which all appear to be peaceful, according to KTLA, as of 1 p.m. today, were visible at UC Irvine, Cal State Long Beach, and Chapman University, just to name a few, Basil.
UC Santa Barbara as well, I believe. And meanwhile, the police in Pennsylvania declined to follow an instruction from the college authorities to break up the encampment there. It seems that there's a real sort of, dare I say it, battle for the soul of intellectual America underway, Brian.
Yes, there is, Basil, and it's going to be interesting to see how this all unfolds, and I'll look forward to speaking with you again real soon. Thanks for having me.
Will do. Thank you, Brian. Brian is, of course, on After the News Headlines with Timothy Shane for another rip-roaring edition of State of the Nation. I'm Basil Valentine. I hope you've enjoyed me sitting in for Patrick. See you all again very soon, and have a great night.